You're listening to the LEMS Aware podcast. Real voices, rare stories, and real support for those navigating life with Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome.
Living with LEMS can be tough, especially since its challenges are often invisible. Most people have no idea what it's really like. Symptoms like fatigue, muscle weakness, and dizziness aren't always obvious, but they can get in the way of productivity at work, make social plans overwhelming, and steal the joy from things you used to love. But more than just identifying the problems, we're here to find solutions. Today, you'll hear from someone with LEMS about how they navigate the toll on their workday and social gatherings. By the end of the episode, we hope you'll walk away with tips on how to manage these invisible symptoms and ultimately reclaim control over your life. Welcome. We have a special guest on today's episode, Maria. Maria was diagnosed with LEMS in 2025, so relatively new, and she is a home health director and administrator. So today we're going to talk a little bit about her diagnosis journey, as well as balancing that work life and social life living with LEMS. So welcome, Maria.
Thank you. It's so good to be on your podcast today.
We are so excited to have you here and have this discussion because I think it's incredibly important to listen to other people's experiences about how do you balance the work life and the social life with your family and your friends and also living with an invisible disease like LEMS. So let's get started. So tell me a little bit about the first onset of symptoms and a little bit about your journey to your diagnosis.
Yeah, so my symptoms started actually in November of 2023. Started, you know, just very, very mild weakness in my legs, like climbing stairs. One of the biggest challenges for me was picking my foot up to put in my car. I have like a little crossover SUV, not crazy tall, but it became a challenge for me to pick my foot up and get in the floorboard of my car to get in. You know, and I was, as a nurse, I was in the field a lot before and had transitioned a few years ago to an office, more of an office job. And my first thought, of course, was, oh, I'm so out of shape. This office job has just, I have got to work out. I've got to get stronger. So, you know, for about probably a good month, 6 weeks, I continuously probably got weaker in my legs. And at the same time, tried to walk on a treadmill or tried to incorporate a little more exercise. There was almost a shame factor to it where I didn't want to tell anyone. Oh, you know, it's hard for me to climb stairs because it felt like it was my shortcoming, that it was something that I wasn't doing correctly because I had this weakness, you know. And even as a nurse in the nursing field, that was still my first thought, was something's wrong with me and I need to try to fix this. So that kind of progressed. After about a month, 6 weeks, I finally told my husband. I was like, I feel like something's wrong. Like, I have this weakness in my legs. And of course, you know, I don't know what's going on. Went to my doctor. We decided it was medication maybe related. Stopped the medicine. Kind of improved a little bit. In February, I started getting weak again. Lower back pain. My arms started becoming involved. Ended up in the hospital in March of 2024. All the tests were normal. MRIs, lumbar puncture, all the labs that they did. Everything came back normal. Ended up neuropsych. Neuropsych came in and they said, you know, you have a stressful job. You have a stressful life. Your symptoms have gotten better here in the hospital, which I was in for 3 or 4 days. Bed rest pretty much, you know, had to have someone come help me get up because I was a fall risk. So that rest I did. I was like, I do feel stronger. You know, maybe it is stress. That would be great. I'll work on some meditation and maybe I'll get better. And still, even through that, in the hospital, I had my laptop. I was still working. I had Zoom calls with tape over the camera because I absolutely didn't want anyone to see me. But, you know, obviously still I'm going through all this personally, but I do have a big job. You know, I'm over a lot of patients, a lot of staff members. And so I'm trying to deal with this and being absolutely terrified. I don't know what's going on with my body. But at the same time, I have all these responsibilities. I have so many people that rely on me. So, of course, you have that stressful component. After I got out of the hospital, still with no diagnosis, I went home and I felt better when I left the hospital. I would say maybe 2-3 hours after I got home, I was in severe pain. My legs, my cramping, hurting from walking out of the hospital to the vehicle, getting in the vehicle, walking into my house.
That must have been so disheartening that you kind of felt, all right, I think we have an answer here. And then almost seems like you took a left turn.
Absolutely. And then, of course, all the doctors had thought, well, like, we've got this figured out. I had really no follow-ups. I had scheduled for an EMG, but it was a month away. Over the next week or so, I just went downhill rapidly.
And how was that time period in balancing, you know, your role?
So I had meetings. I had work. I tried my best to go to those. That next week was the first time that I failed. I actually had a meeting. We have multiple offices, multiple sites. I have clinical managers over each site. And every month I pull those clinical managers in for a meeting to go over, you know, just everything going on with our agency. And I had a meeting with them. They were coming in and I was trying to get out to my car and I fell. It was my first fall, trying to, you know, step down into my garage. And I was home by myself. My husband had already left. My kids had already left. And so I knew I had to get to work. To me, I had no choice because I'd pulled, you know, they'd driven an hour each to come to my area for this meeting. I had multiple people come in. I lay there and cried for a few minutes. And then, because I was so weak, I mean, it was my arms, my legs. I just did not have the strength. And that I was able to kind of push myself up a little bit, crawl to my car, pull myself up, get in my car, and I just sat there in my car, rested for a few minutes, flipped my mirror down, you know, fixed my eyes, took some deep breaths, and was like, okay, you've got to go to work. So drove to work. Now, I did have to come to work and then call and say, hey, we have a walker in there. Can someone bring that to me? Because at that point, I had no medical equipment. You know, we were still so, I had no walker. I had no wheelchair. I had no cane. I had no equipment.
Up until this point, did you talk to any of your coworkers or, you know, anyone you report to about these symptoms and what you're going through? Or is this still the discovery phase?
So this was still kind of the discovery phase. Obviously, they knew I was in the hospital, but we didn't know what to tell anyone. I mean, I talked to my supervisor about it. Something's going on, but we didn't know what. I mean, you can't really announce to, you know, your staff that, I don't know.
Was there a reaction when you said, can you bring out a walker? Does that just elevate the concern?
Yes. So the concern went to a whole nother level. And it's, you know, my supervisor saying, maybe you shouldn't be at work. Maybe you shouldn't be at work. But at the same time, I don't want to give up my job. I mean, at this point, I don't know how long this is going to last. I don't know if this is my new normal. I don't know. And so I got the walker, helped me inside. We got through the meeting, ended up getting, you know, of course, all the equipment over the next week. I got a walker, a shower chair, a wheelchair.
Can imagine having, you know, no answers, but you still have to get these, this equipment. Yeah.
You know, and so just trying to figure out, trying to get everything I needed, trying to equip my home the way I needed it, ended up work. I just had to work from home some days. There were days I had to tell my boss, you know, I can't make it to the office today. I can't because I got a manual wheelchair. On the days I was weakest, I couldn't use it because there's a ramp coming into the office. I couldn't use my arms to push myself up the ramp. And I was not, in my mind, going to ask someone to push me in the wheelchair, you know, to come and get me out of the car and push me up the ramp. So when I was able to work from home, that I didn't have a meeting or I didn't have something that I needed to be present for that probably April, May, June, a lot of that time I worked from home, other than for meetings or different things. Was on, you know, a couple of different treatments.
It seems like your office was pretty receptive to you. Did you have those discussions and work through that on, I need to stay home? And or is that a challenging discussion to have?
It was a challenging discussion, which I have a wonderful team here. You know, our CEO is wonderful. But at the same time, I would say, I'm not going to be able to come in today. And she would say, we need to have a meeting. We have to put plans in place. What if you, you know, can't continue to work? And it was very hard conversations to have, but I understood, even though it hurt my feelings anyway, you know, you kind of can't help feeling that feeling of, you know, they're trying to push me out or they're trying to replace me or I'm not able to do my job. But I understood, obviously, as a manager, that you have to have those plans in place because I didn't know what was going to happen. I didn't know what my diagnosis was. And so, of course, we did FMLA paperwork. They sent me FMLA paperwork after my hospitalization. And we did that on an intermittent basis. And of course, this is my PCP still doing all this. You know, she's trying treatments for me. I don't have an appointment with a neurologist until July, I believe. Went and did an EMG. It didn't show anything really. You know, there was nothing. And it got to the point where, I believe it was in May, called a rheumatologist, and was like, because I'm guessing at this point, I'm trying to self-diagnose. I'm like, maybe it's polymyositis. It's proximal muscle weakness, you know, just these things. And I'm going, I'm crying on the phone because they're telling me they can't see me for 6 months. And I'm going, I can't stand. I can't get out of a wheelchair at this point. I'm getting choked trying to swallow food. And I can't cough strong enough to clear my airway when I get choked. So, you know, all of the things, all of the symptoms that go along with the LEMS diagnosis, and I was terrified. And so, you know, of course, the rheumatologist got me in. She did more testing for like the myositis, MRIs of my muscles, different things. All of that was negative. One of the treatments that my PCP, my primary doctor, had used was steroids. And she ended up saying, okay, all your weakness is from the steroids. And I'm going, because she had taken me off of them. And I had improved some with that. This was like towards the end of July, August. And she said, I think it was all just steroid-induced myopathy. But I was weak before I ever started the steroids.
Right. Exactly. And how did things change for you once you finally got into a neurologist?
So, which I had seen neurology, you know, when I was in the hospital. And then I had seen another neurologist when I went and got my EMG. They told me my EMG was not showing really anything and I needed to go to see rheumatology. So I'd seen a couple of neurologists. So then the rheumatologist was like, I'm done. There's nothing, you know, with there. She was like, it's steroid-induced myopathy. I had to ask and beg for another referral to neurology. She was like, I really don't think there's anything. I think you've gotten a little better. And, you know, I think it was from the steroids and you're going to keep improving.
And as a nurse, you know how to advocate for yourself.
Yes. Well, yeah. And I could feel that I was getting weaker again since I'd been off the steroids. And
yeah.
You know, with LEMS patients, a lot of times the office tests that they do don't truly give you a picture of the amount of weakness that you have. It's just not going to paint that adequate picture of truly how weak you are when they have you press against their, you know, hands and do those tests. So she did get me an appointment. Again, it was for December. Again, after about a month into August, I was getting so weak again. I called and I cried again on the phone and said, I have to be seen. Instantly, when I went and saw them, my diagnosis was myasthenia gravis. I mean, he, you know, one visit and said, you have myasthenia gravis. We're going to do all the blood work for it, but there's seronegative myasthenia gravis. You have all the symptoms. At this point, I was starting to have some ptosis, which started the droopy eyes, which started later. It about July maybe is when that started. Some double vision, was having those symptoms. So I was like, oh, this fits. Yes, let's do this. So went down that treatment path, helped a little bit, not a lot. Still, you know, working full time. I am juggling. Now I'm having appointments for, I have to go get labs. He wants to see me a week later. He wants to see me 2 weeks later. I'm running out of sick leave, but I have the FMLA. So that's kind of covering that. My boss is still, you know, we're having these conversations and she's saying, you know, we need you here in person. We know we're letting you work from home because, you know, and she's coming to me with, I don't know how much trust your staff has in you with you being out so much. Like, we have to show that it's that you're good, that you're going to be able to do this job, that you're capable, that, you know, for the staff to be secure in their job. Because if your administrator's sick and your administrator's out, then you have, you know, that's your foundation for your agency. So very hard to hear, very hard, you know, to try to work through. There'd be days I would message my boss and say, I can't do it. I would be sitting on the side of the bed and trying to get dressed and couldn't pick my foot up to, you know, to put pants on.
And I can't imagine sending that message after the conversations that you've had with her where she's losing that trust, you know, that must have been really difficult.
It was probably one of the hardest things that I had done, you know, and then I had staff meetings, I have quarterly meetings with all of my staff, all of my nurses, PTs, you know, about 40 people that would come. We serve 12 counties for the agency I work for. And so pull all those staff from everywhere in, we all meet. And our normal meeting spot is a basement in a building that you have to go downstairs to get to.
Wow, I can see where this is going.
So I had to, you know, and that's where we always have had it. I had to ask for an accommodation for that. I had to say, okay, you know what? I can't get up and down those steps. There's no handicap access to that area. So we had to move not only to a different building, but to a different town. And we had to, you know, when it was a building that one of our employees had access to. So we had to move to something that had to be paid for. We had to rent, had the access. And then I had to go in a wheelchair because I couldn't at the time.
You're still navigating this diagnosis journey. How did you eventually get diagnosed with LEMS after getting the MG diagnosis?
It was that he diagnosed me with seronegative MG. And he said, like, my EMG that I had gotten was the wrong EMG. They did not do the single fiber or the repetitive EMG. And, you know, the neurologist, he said, if they would have done that, it would have definitively said you have MG. So, and then he did a CT of my thymus to see if I had like a mass there for MG. That was negative. So the tests that he did were negative, but again, he told me it was seronegative MG. I did have some response to the therapy, the treatment that he tried. He was like, it's definitely it. He told me 150% positive that this is it. Well, one of the things when he did his assessment was I had no reflexes. So, you know, my legs, my arms, when they did the reflex test, I had completely absent reflexes. And so he asked me, he said, or I asked him, I said, why do I not have reflexes? And he said, well, that can happen with MG. We can see that. Well, again, I'm a nurse. I go home. I want to know why things are happening in my body. What is making these things happen in my body? So I looked up, why do you not have reflexes with myasthenia gravis? And what popped up was most of the time you do have reflexes or just maybe mildly decreased reflexes with myasthenia gravis. However, there's this other thing called Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome that mostly has absent reflexes or areflexia. And I was like, oh, what's that? So then I started looking for that information and finding those comparisons. And, you know, it was the things that the myasthenia gravis usually starts with the face, with the ocular, with the speech, and then it can go down to generalized myasthenia. But the Lambert-Eaton usually starts in the legs, with that weakness in the legs, and then it can progress more upward. And I'm like, oh, that sounds more like what happened to me.
I was going to say, that sounds like
yeah,
me.
Yeah, that sounds like me. Yep. And of course, then you also see that there's this larger association with cancer. So then, of course, that's scary. Mm-hmm. Next visit, which was, I think, 2 weeks later, I went back. Actually, I think I sent a message through my chart portal that day and said, hey, can we test for this? No response. I went back 2 weeks later and I was like, hey, can we test for this? I feel like this matches my symptoms. He said, absolutely not. There's absolutely no reason to. You've had some response to this treatment we've done for the MG, and I'm 150% positive that this is myasthenia gravis. This is what you have. That other's a cancer-associated thing. You don't have cancer. You know, we've done this chest CT, all the things. So for 6 months, he treated me for myasthenia gravis. three different times I asked him to test me for Lambert-Eaton. I was like, just do the blood work. He's like, there's absolutely no need. I'm telling you, we're going to do this treatment. You're going to feel so much better. We're going to have you doing great. And he'd start another treatment or he'd increase this other medicine. And it did help a little. It did not help a lot. And there's this fear in the back of my mind that, okay, what if this is, what if there's a cancer somewhere? And my thing is, though, I live in a very rural town. That neurologist was an hour away from me. The closest larger hospital neurologist is 3 hours away from me.
Quite a trek.
And of course, my biggest fear is if I switch to this neurologist that's 3 hours from me, how much more work am I going to have to miss? Because right now, I could take a half a day and go to this doctor or just work until 2 in the afternoon and go to this doctor.
Yeah.
But if I switch to a physician that's 3.5 hours away or 3, you know, I'm going to have to take all day every time. And right now, you know, at that point, I was going back and forth for tests or to see him probably every couple of weeks. Yeah. And my husband is having to take off work as well to go with me, to take me. We have teenage children that, you know, are in school and have school
Those
activities.
Those are big responsibilities, yeah.
Yes. And so I thought, Maria, stop trying to self-diagnose yourself. You know, just he's the doctor. He's been doing this a long time. Finally, actually, it was a friend of mine said, hey, I know someone who's got myasthenia gravis and she's lived with it a long time. Why don't you call her and talk to her? So I talked to that person and we were discussing and she said, you're so uncontrolled still. You know, I was still short of breath with every sentence. I was still super weak, like reaching for my keyboard on my desk was a chore, especially in the afternoons. She said, you're not what you should be with the medicine you're on if this was myasthenia gravis. She said, I encourage you to go get a second opinion. And I thought, this was now in January of this year, 2025.
Of this year, yeah, yes. 2025.
Yes. So over a year, you know, I've been kind of struggling with this. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do it. So I actually called the larger hospital. I made an appointment with the neurologist. Tried to. They couldn't see me without a referral from my neurologist. So then I had to call my neurologist, who absolutely had insisted this entire time that he did not want to test me for Lambert-Eaton. And I called them. He said he would not give me a referral until I came back in and saw him again, which is also very hard as a patient, even though I'm a nurse, to go and look and the face of this doctor and pretty much say, I don't trust what you're telling me. I want someone else, you know, because then what if I am wrong and I have to still keep seeing this physician? You have that fear. Is he going to treat me the same? Is he going to, you know, but I did it. And I told him, I said, I absolutely want this, a referral to this other hospital. I want to get a second opinion. He did go ahead and send it. I went and saw that physician in February of this year. My first appointment with her, I told her everything. We started from scratch, from the beginning. And she said, she did my physical assessment. Of course, I had no reflexes still. I had, you know, all the things. And she said, I'm just going to tell you that your examination is more consistent with Lambert. She said, I want to do a single fiber EMG today. She said, you're so far away. I'd rather, if you don't mind sitting in the waiting room, I'm going to call your insurance. We're going to see if I can get, you know, today.
Fantastic that she would be willing to do that. That's great.
And so we did within an hour. I was over in the department to get the EMG and he hooked me up. Within 15 minutes of starting the test, the neurologist looked at me and said, you have Lambert-Eaton. And I just started.
What was your reaction? I knew it.
I just cried, though. I cried. And I looked at my husband and I was like, I knew that's what it was.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, and so, Maria, where you've done a beautiful job just laying out exactly, you know, the year that you went through or year and a half you went through of struggling and working with your work. Let's talk about the Maria prior to LEMS. And what was a typical work day? You know, was it physical? I know you were talking about you have a lot of staff. What did that look like on a day-to-day basis?
So it was first of all, I was always up early. I was always the first one at the office. You know, before time to be here. I was usually here late most days. I was always the supervisor who, if my nurses were busy or the staff was busy in the field, I would say, let me go do this visit, or, you know, or if in our intake department came and said, you know, the hospital just called with a patient and everybody's full, I'd say, I'll go see that patient, you know. So I was at a desk job, but I was never fully at a desk job. I was always wanting to still be out and providing patient care and doing that. Weekends, I was seeing patients on the weekend before I went to the hospital, struggling to get up their back steps because, you know, we had one nurse on call for 12 counties. And so if it was a patient that was closer to my area, I would go see that patient. I was just always going, always doing with my kids. And then, you know, of course, this hit, and it was just such total shock to me and so frustrating. But yes, my job was definitely a lot
demanding. Sounds demanding.
Very.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So now let's fast forward to today. How does it look today, you know, managing LEMS with your pretty demanding job?
So I very much have had to pull back some. I don't see patients really in their homes anymore. I'll go see some, but I have to, you know, with home health, there's a wide variety of patients that you see. I can go see a patient who maybe all we're doing is education, but I maybe can't go see a patient who has several wounds or something that I would really have to be more physical to turn that patient over or to crouch down, I guess, you know, to get to their feet, or because that's just those more physically demanding things I can't necessarily do. So,
and you're still having those conversations with, you know, your supervisor to say, okay, this is what I can do, this is what I can't do.
Yes. I did have to complete a return to work physical to be back in the field at all. For me to work from the office or from home, I didn't necessarily have to do that. But of course, for safety reasons, I did have to be able to complete that. Once I had my diagnosis, though, and got on the correct medication, which one of the things the neurologist did was she stopped everything that I was on. So that was a bad week because what I had was working some. It wasn't the best, but it was helping. But I mean, I was able to get on the correct medicine so quickly. Like, I feel like it was wonderful how quickly she was able to work on that and get that going and get that medication to me. And so after that, I was at least able to do like the return to work physical. Now, I feel like my supervisor's management, they still don't want me in the field at all because I do still have some good days and some bad days. There is still a question of trust there that I feel that. And, you know, I want to say, you know, I'm careful. I know my body. I know what I can and can't do. But them as managers also have to say they have some liability there. So it's a very fine line on what I'm able to do or what they want me to do. Because technically, like I passed the return to work physical. I was able to transfer the 30-pound weight and I was able to squat and pick that up and transfer that and to walk the amount that I needed to walk in the time that I needed to walk it. But as we all know with LEMS, some days are good and some days are not.
And how do you navigate, I would say, the good days? You're probably, this is fantastic. How do you navigate the bad days?
It's still very difficult. And it's still very difficult for me. I will wake up in the morning and I have what I call the arm test. So when I wake up in bed, I'll kind of raise my arm up and see how heavy it is to me. So I know if my arm's really heavy, it's not a good morning. It's not a good day. Sometimes I have to call my boss and say, or email her and say, I'm going to be in late today. It's going to be a late day. Or sometimes we'll drag myself kind of into the office and she'll see me and she'll go, it's not good today, is it? And I'm like, no. And then she's going to my coworkers and saying, go check on Maria in a little while.
Oh, that is fantastic. But after this entire process, do you have any, you know, thoughts or some recommendations for anyone just starting out on this navigation of balancing LEMS and, you know, your work life? Is there something that you would have done differently, or is there something that really worked for you?
I would say, first off, give yourself grace and trust the people that you work with. And I know that not every situation are those people that you work with or the supervisors that you have going to be as understanding. But I think I was probably harder on myself and more demanding of myself than what they demanded of me. And I think I took everything so much more to heart and so much more personally, and it made it more difficult on me. Because I said earlier, you know, I would call my boss and say, I can't come in today. And then I would go, I'm going to get fired. I'm going to lose my job. And I knew intellectually that they couldn't do that, but that fear is still so real that I would just drag myself up and to work and push myself hard and then pay for it that evening or that next day. And at the same time, though, I had to, you know, ask for those accommodations. Don't be afraid to ask for those. I probably waited too long to ask for those as well. Be aware of the, you know, the FMLA, the things that are there that are put in place to help you. And, you know, if there'd come a point we had the conversation where, you know, maybe I'm not going to be able to continue being the director. What other options are there within the company that I might be able to do?
That because, I can still do this.
Yes, because even though it would be hard for me to give up my position, I've worked a long time to get to where I'm at. Mm-hmm. I would still rather do something within
some portion of it,
yes.
Some part of it.
Yes.
To still keep that fulfillment.
Correct.
You know, because I can tell you are very passionate about what you do.
I am.
And you put 100% into it. And do you have time for social life? Because I want to talk a little bit about what you do for your social life. And I think you're, you know, living in a smaller town. You're probably very busy. What is that like? And how have you adjusted your social life?
So my biggest social life, I guess, is my family. I mean, I've never been the type to go out a lot with, you know, other people, but family time is everything to me. You know, I have one son who lives a little bit away in college and the other son who's in college but still at home, and then another who's in high school. And so vacations are huge for me when we can all get together as a family, when, you know, just we have a boat that we go out on the lake. And I mean, those things I did the same way I did work. I'm like, okay, we're going out on the boat today. And my husband's like, we can't do that. And I'm like, we're going to take the wheelchair because I couldn't walk from the parking lot down to the little pier. So we would still go. Used to, I'd jump in the lake with no cares in the world. Now it's a life jacket. You know, I have to have the life jacket.
Those little adjustments, just to make sure you're safe.
Mm-hmm. I'm not in the water without it, not near the edge of the rails without it. Vacation. So we went on a cruise in January of this year when I was still very weak and before
Goodness.
My diagnosis.
Yeah, pre-diagnosis.
Yes, and we had it booked for over a year, and I was not going to give that up either. I was like, you know, if I have to make that adjustment, and I had to take a wheelchair, and my family had to push me around, but we did it anyway because I wanted that. Now, the biggest probably thing here in town that I had to adjust to, because obviously we live in a small town, I've been in healthcare a long time, so everybody, we all know each other. Everybody knows me. I didn't go out, hardly any, because I didn't want to be seen out in public with my walker in a wheelchair. I couldn't go to Walmart. The first time I was able to go back to Walmart was a huge deal for me that I was able to use the cart to walk around Walmart a little bit. So that the first time I went to a football game and I had to take my walker. So difficult. I mean, to walk in front of everybody, you know, I'm in my 40s, so.
It's a small town. And when you're going to a football game with a walker, first of all, did you get the attention that I'm assuming you got? Second
yes.
of all, how did you explain what was going on?
It's so hard. I just had to say, you know, I have something neuromuscular going on. Like, we knew that much. You know, I just have muscular weakness and we don't know what it is. And like my child that's in high school didn't want to tell any of his friends, didn't want to share that because what do you tell them? He's like, I don't want people to ask about you because I don't know what to tell them. Very difficult, you know, to try to explain. Of course, there for a little bit, they were like,
how do you navigate the adjustments now? You know, you said, you know, you make the life jacket or you, you know, maybe slow down a little bit or you're not doing as many social things as you're doing. How do your friends and family react to that? And how do you have those conversations?
They're a lot better now. I think like one of the things that I did once I got a definitive diagnosis was I did a Facebook post. And I know, you know, the whole social media thing. I thought, you know, let's just get this all out there. Let's make it public, share it with everybody. This is what's going on. And I make a point now to really share, like, you know, the NORD, the Rare Disease Day, the Lambert-Eaton's Day, the, you know, to remind people this is what's going on. And so I try to just get that awareness out there. And I tell my kids, I'm like, tell people, tell them my mother has Lambert-Eaton. If you don't know what that is, look it up. But things like his band teacher, you know, we went to a marching competition and it was sitting in the stands at the football field. And we were supposed to go check our kids out. And my son was like, no, you have to come to my mom because she can't climb these bleachers to where you're at. And you know, he was like, I made him come to you. I was like, I could have at least.
Oh, what a good son.
Yes, you know.
love that.
So it is those adjustments that you make and those things that you do. But I think that the awareness and the letting everybody know and getting it out there has absolutely helped. It's helped both, you know, it's helped my kids feel more confident and comfortable in talking about it to their friends and to their teachers. And it's helped just everybody in the community, I think, when they see me, they're like, okay, you look better than you did.
That is fantastic advice. Exactly. And just having those open, honest conversations.
Absolutely.
And making everyone aware. You said, you know, the awareness is incredibly key. And then you build almost your local, you know, support system, you know, surrounding you.
And, you know, and that was, I think, the hardest part of being not diagnosed was then you didn't have those answers and you didn't know what to say to people. But, you know, once you get that diagnosis, it opens up so many more avenues. And then, you know, the support groups, and that's just all been huge in helping
you and surrounding you. Yeah, absolutely. Maria, this has been phenomenal. And is there any last words of wisdom that you would like to tell the audience?
I would just say for everyone, just do not give up. No matter what, whether it's with getting that diagnosis, getting to that right doctor, being able to keep your job, don't let that depression that tries to pull you down, don't let it take you, you know, just try to keep pushing through. And I promise it will get better if you keep pushing and just do not give up.
That is fantastic advice. Thank you so much. Maria, thank you so much for joining us
here
today.
Welcome.
And we really appreciate having you.
Okay, no problem. Thank you so much.
And to our listeners, thanks for joining us here today. If you're looking for more information about all things LEMS, be sure to head over to lemsaware.com.